On Sunday, the Broncos face the Seahawks in the first ever outdoor cold weather Super Bowl. Want a 30-second Super Bowl ad? You'll need $4 million. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. How did the business of football get so big? That's a question we look at in the first half hour. Also, the Super Bowl's tradition of unusual high-profile TV ads. Then an insider's perspective on the pressure a big game puts on players and officials. We'll talk with former NFL players and former Hawkeyes, Nate Kading and Sean Considine. Also, Iowan Scott Helverson, a back judge in the NFL for 11 years. He's officiated two Super Bowls. We'll kick off right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This Sunday, the Denver Broncos will face the Seattle Seahawks in what is the first ever outdoor cold weather Super Bowl. It'll be held at MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey. So this hour, we want to talk about football as big business and also have some insider perspective. For instance, what is it like to play or officiate in a high-profile game? Nate Kading and Sean Considine will be among my guests, two former NFL players, also former Hawkeyes. Also, we'll have on board an Iowan who has officiated in two Super Bowls. But first, let's get our footing from this business perspective of the Super Bowl by talking with Dan Matheson. He's a lecturer in the Recreation and Sport Business Program at the University of Iowa. Hi, Dan.
Hi, happy to be here.
Let's take this business perspective back to the first Super Bowl and have you tell us a little bit about the chronology as you see it. The first one in January of 1967, Green Bay defeating Kansas City. What can you tell us about how this started the ball rolling to be the huge phenomenon and business that the Super Bowl is today?
Well, when you think about the business of the Super Bowl, it all starts with the television ratings that the game draws. And so when you go back, the Super Bowl has always drawn large viewership, and that's continued to grow pretty steadily over the history of the Super Bowl. And anytime you have eyeballs on any event like that, it offers an opportunity to generate revenue for broadcasters to sell advertising, for advertisers to be seen by consumers. And so in terms of a event that's perfectly packaged for all kinds of different interests, business interests to develop themselves, the Super Bowl is where it's at.
Talk about that. You use the phrase perfectly packaged. I'm starting to picture football, of course, baseball on television is big, the World Series, basketball, the playoffs and so forth. What makes football the perfect package for the interest that you're describing?
Well, one aspect certainly is everything's decided in one 60-minute game. Baseball, you're playing 4 out of 7 games. Basketball, you're playing 4 out of 7 games. So the
60 minutes on the clock, but actually 4 hours
in
real people's time, right?
Of course.
Right.
But I mean, anytime you start talking about a 4 out of 7 series that has to bounce back and forth between different locations and those locations not being known until those two teams qualify, with the Super Bowl, you know years in advance where that is going to be. And really, the teams that make it, that's great. But everybody's already focused from a business standpoint on New York City, for instance, this year.
How much money is tied to this one game, the Super Bowl? Any idea?
Oh, it would be hard for me to estimate. But I will say that advertising buys this year are roughly $4 million for a 30-second television spot during the game, of which there are, you know, dozens and dozens. Fox has paid substantially to televise the Super Bowl. The one interesting thing about the revenue that's generated by the Super Bowl is that the way the league structures its revenue sharing plan, the teams that are participating in the Super Bowl often don't make that much direct revenue from the Super Bowl. The NFL has a very socialist business model where they share things very equally compared to most other sports. But what it ends up happening, there's significant expense associated with an NFL team going on a run all the way to the Super Bowl. And so those expenses aren't always matched by the revenue that's collected. And then, you know, the next year, many of those players are looking for increases in their contracts. Coaching staff is looking for increases in contracts. So there are subsequent expenses that are kind of built into having that much success. On the flip side, it does offer a team and an owner a chance to maybe increase ticket prices in future seasons, increase fees to sponsors to be associated with their team in future years. So there's a chance to increase their revenues, but not necessarily – not as if most fans might think, well, you go to the Super Bowl and the team that – the two teams that are participating are receiving a big fat check for being there, for winning, and not quite that way.
What can you say about who are the biggest money makers in this event?
I would say the biggest beneficiary – in response to your question, would have to be the league, the NFL overall, certainly the participating teams in terms of branding their organization benefit. But financially, all that revenue flows through the league office. And so the league certainly would be considered the biggest beneficiary in my opinion.
This is the first ever outdoor cold weather Super Bowl to be held in East Rutherford, New Jersey. How does that make business sense? Or is it a test? Is it a risk?
No question it's a risk. They've been holding press conferences as recently as I think yesterday and today talking about what's our contingency plan if we get dumped on by a foot of snow on Saturday or Sunday. And their contingency, as you're probably aware, is we could move the game to Saturday or Monday if we need to, or change the starting time, which would wreak havoc on the network schedules and all kinds of plans that people have and travelers who are there and sponsors. It would be a messy situation.
Dan, talk a little bit more about this location in this first cold weather outdoor Super Bowl. It's being actually held in New Jersey, but is that really the business location for this?
Well, that's been an intriguing part for me. In addition to the weather, which is an unorthodox choice to hold it in a cold city, with the host city and state being New Jersey and East Rutherford, The real business epicenter for this event is Manhattan. And so New Jersey and the area surrounding the venue really isn't feeling all of the financial impact that New York City is.
But having to carry many of the costs.
Exactly. And I've been intrigued watching and reading about some of the responses from politicians in New Jersey and residents in New Jersey. And I think it was expected and understood, I think, by New Jersey that would be the situation. And residents of New Jersey have probably grown accustomed to New York being the destination, not New Jersey. But it changes the dynamics a little bit because all the sponsors are activating their sponsorships in New York. Pepsi has built a huge 10,000 square foot dome in Bryant Park for hosting parties and other entertainment. Anheuser-Busch has a 1,000 foot cruise ship set up as a Bud Light hotel or something like that. And all of this And the NFL has their, I think they're calling it Super Bowl Boulevard or something like that. It's an entertainment district, so to speak, that goes up. They have a gigantic toboggan slide in Times Square and all kinds of other activities going on. And all of that going on in New York, which is bringing all those consumers, those fans of this game, to New York to spend their money there, which New Jersey residents are saying, we're not getting the full economic benefit that the NFL claimed that we would because of this.
But if this gamble, this risk of this location, cold weather location, pays off, I have to believe we could see more Super Bowls at this place.
It absolutely. I mean, obviously, the New York, New Jersey area offers a lot in terms of entertainment and attention, and people are drawn to that area. If the weather holds out, it'd be a great place to go for a game.
Dan Matheson, lecturer in the Recreation and Sport Business Program at the University of Iowa. It's been enlightening. Thank you very much, and enjoy the Super Bowl.
Thank you, Ben. You too.
I'm so excited. I'm going to get cream.
Yeah, yeah. Let Maxima cream your face. Hey, hey, hey. Some freezer won't.
Woo!
Maxima cream. Maxima
the closer you shave, the more you need creamy, soothing, medicated Noxema.
Let Noxema cream your face.
Hey, hey, hey.
Some razors don't.
You've got a great pair of hands.
Classic football commercial, Joe Namath, Farrah Fawcett from the 1970s. Big impression made on many of us who were around at the time made by that commercial. We're talking the big business of football this hour on the eve of the Super Bowl. Let's talk about those ads for a few minutes, ads that can be, these days, as much of a draw for some viewers as the game itself. Russ Lasniak is with us, professor of marketing at Iowa State University. Hi, Russ.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. So a 30-second ad, over $4 million? How can that be worth it?
How can it be worth it? Well, I think that one of the big attractions of the Super Bowl, first off, is the sheer size of the audience. Dan just mentioned that it is one of the largest and typically the largest viewed program in the country each year. So just the massive size of the audience, the number of people that you can reach is huge. The second part, which makes the Super Bowl very, very unique, is that, as you just alluded to, many people watch the Super Bowl to watch the ads. I mean, I think we all hear stories, and we've probably all had the experience of being in a room. The game's on, it's loud, people are at a Super Bowl party, and then there's a break in the action, and people literally say, shh, the ads are on. And
yeah,
so the excitement
right.
of seeing a new creative ad actually draws people to, you know, not avoid ads like they typically do when they're watching a 30-minute sitcom. They actually are drawn to the ads and want to watch them and see what's there.
Mm-hmm. The Super Bowl itself, going back to the late 60s, but how did this happen with the ads? Did someone make a conscious decision that this was going to be the place where people didn't try to ignore ads, but focused on them?
I'm not so sure that anybody made the conscious decision, but I do believe that beginning in the 1980s, people started to notice that it was a big deal. And I think, we talk today about buzz and buzz surrounding ads as though it's commonplace. But really, one of the first ads that really created buzz was a Super Bowl ad from 1980, the Mean Joe Green ad from Coca-Cola, where a little boy was standing in a tunnel and Mean Joe Green from the Pittsburgh Steelers walked out and looked tired and thirsty. And the little boy said, here you go, Mean.
We have the audio from that. Let's give a listen to this.
What, right.
1980, Mean Joe Green.
Right.
We'll remember this ad. Let's have a listen.
Please, give him
that. Mr. Green?
Yeah.
You need any help?
Mm-mm.
I just want you to know, I think you're the best ever.
Yeah, sure.
Want my Coke? It's okay, you can have it.
No.
Really, you can have it.
Okay.
A Coke and a smile.
We know what happens after that. What happens, Russ? In return for the Coke, what does the boy get?
The boy gets Mean Joe's jersey, and Everybody loves it, and the buzz starts because people start talking about that ad. How
right. I remember as a boy seeing that, and see, if I got a jersey like that, I mean, my face flushed just thinking of the idea of having Mean Joe Greene throw his jersey toward me. So this started the trend, and they noticed that this ad was well worth it. And what makes an ad on the Super Bowl effective?
What makes it so effective is that the audience is actually paying attention. And what makes it a bit challenging, though, is that they want to be entertained. People are watching largely not because they want to learn about brands, because they want to be entertained. And advertisers over the years have largely delivered, at least the perception from consumers, is they've delivered by providing entertaining ads. And, that's the key is to engage people, is to get them to watch, pay attention, and remember.
Okay. That ad actually from 1979, I believe, the Mean Joe Greene ad. Let's go forward a few years to another iconic Super Bowl ad, the 1984 Apple ad. Before we hear a little audio from that, what do you want to tell us about it?
What I want to tell you about it is it's largely known as one of the most creative ads of all time. What's interesting is it's become iconic. I think the immediate reaction to the ad was not quite as positive and, dare I even say, negative at first. Over time, it's actually gotten to an iconic stage.
Mm-hmm. And we have to remember, Apple at this time was not the name that we know it as today. It had not – all of that success was yet to be realized. And so let's listen to the audio. But before we do that, tell us, what are we seeing in this ad?
What we are seeing is that this is a society that was supposedly depicted in George Orwell's 1984 book and his novel, and it's people basically as robots, and somebody tries to break that mold.
Let's listen.
Today we celebrate the first glorious anniversary of the information purification directives we have created for the first time. In all history, a garden of pure ideology, where each worker may bloom, secure from the pests of a contradictory force. Our unification of the force is more powerful a weapon than any fleet or army on earth. We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause. Themselves to death, and we will bury them with their own confusion. We shall prevail.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh, and you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
Talking about Super Bowl ads with Russ Lasniak, professor of marketing at Iowa State University. The two ads that we just played do not show humor in them, but they are humor is a part of a lot of Super Bowl ads, isn't it?
Humor is a big deal. And I think in more recent times, as people have clamored, as I just mentioned earlier, for entertainment, humor is a fairly easy way to do that. And so humor has become a important part of these ads, certainly.
Another trend that you're seeing, social media getting to be a part of it?
Social media is a huge part of it. I think probably an integration of the TV ads as well as social media is a big deal. I believe it was 2 years ago that GoDaddy actually asked viewers, while you're watching our ad, why don't you pull out your laptop and go to GoDaddy, and you can actually watch an enhanced version of this ad, a longer version. And in some cases, they'll show you a completion to a story that they introduce on the TV ad.
Mm-hmm. What are you watching this year? What are you looking at this year? Because it's ramping up already, of course, the days before the Super Bowl.
Well, what we're watching for this year is that idea to engage. I think that's the one thing that people have been talking about. It's if a lot of listeners have noticed, but many ads are already out there. I've seen estimates that say between 50% and 70% of the ads have already been available. And so what the idea will be to encourage people to go back, revisit them, see enhanced versions, go to social media. If you liked our ad, go to the social media page, Facebook page, and tell everybody you liked it. And so then your friends will note that you liked it, and they'll go to the website and watch an enhanced version of that same ad.
As a matter of fact, a very good start for people to do would be to check out Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. There we have a link that has a lot of the classic Super Bowl ads to it. Go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. On the other side, we've only talked about the successes, but an ad person who creates a multi-million dollar flop and pays big money to have it air for 30 seconds, that, think of the pressure there, huh?
There's tremendous pressure, and there's been efforts to try to entertain, and there's many lists, as you might suspect, about what the biggest bombs are of all time. But one thing that I almost consistently see that people refer to is the Bud Bowl craze of several years ago. Budweiser tried to have a series of ads during the game that actually had, I believe it was the blue team against the red team, and it was bottles against cans playing football. They thought it would really entertain people, but the fact of the matter is I don't think too many people became too engaged in or cheering too much for either the red team or the blue team or the silver team, whatever they were.
That they didn't want to follow two games, one real and one fictional.
Exactly. And they had nothing at stake in who won the Bud Bowl.
Yeah. Now, very, very quickly before we have to go, there was politics getting into this, too. We had Clint Eastwood, halftime in America in the 2012 Super Bowl, a two-minute-long ad featuring, most of all, Clint Eastwood's gravelly voice. It led many to believe that Clint was an Obama backer, and we found out during the GOP convention that wasn't the case.
Well, Chrysler would tell you that it was definitely not a political ad. It was all about their brand and their comeback, and Detroit would tell you it was all about the comeback of the city and the U.S. automobile manufacturing market. But it is interesting, and again, that's a great example of buzz that happens. And it's a huge winner for the advertisers. People are talking about that ad even today, which is just helping the U.S. automakers as they reminisce about that ad.
Okay, so you're going to be tucked away in your living room watching the Super Bowl?
I will be.
Yes,
I will be. And
do you have a score sheet for the ads? Are you going to say give that one a 10? That one gets a 3.
That's a little too much work for me. but I guarantee you that when the first pot of ads come up, somebody in our room will say, "Shh, the ads are on."
So. Russ Lasniak, professor of marketing at Iowa State University, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with an NFL official who has been part of two Super Bowls, the Iowa one, and also with two former NFL players. One of them threw a key block in this play you're about to hear during the 2012 Super Bowl, a block that helped allow a 108 or 9-yard kick returned by the Baltimore Ravens. That's coming up in just a moment.
Now this could be a run back from 9 deep for Jacoby Jones. And look at him go. Jones is past the 50, and he is flying inside the 20, and a kickoff return, 109 yards and a touchdown, an all-time record.
When we come back, we'll talk with Nate Kading, former NFL place kicker. He's the second most accurate field kicker in all of NFL history. Also, Sean Considine. He played in the NFL for 7 years. He was part of the play you just heard. Special teams for the Baltimore Ravens to help them win that Super Bowl. We'll also be talking with Scott Helverson, a back judge in the NFL for 11 years. He's officiated in two Super Bowls. That's coming up in just a moment. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Glad to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about football as big business this hour on the eve of the Super Bowl this weekend, a cultural phenomenon where the actual game has become the centerpiece of a much larger, colossal, multi-day event. And now, this half hour, an insider's perspective on all the pressure that such a big game puts on players and officials. We have two former NFL players and a former Hawkeyes. Nate Kading is with us in our Iowa City studio. Welcome back, Nate.
Thanks, Ben.
Sean Considine is with us as well, joining us by telephone. Hello, Sean.
How you doing, Ben?
Great. Also, Iowan Scott Helverson, a back judge in the NFL for 11 years. He's officiated two Super Bowls. I believe officiated the Pro Bowl last week, didn't you, Scott?
That's correct. How are you?
Very good. You're joining us from where?
I'm in Des Moines.
You're in Des Moines. Very good. Nate Kading, former NFL place kicker for the San Diego Chargers, mostly retired in 2012, second most accurate field goal kicker in the NFL. And Sean Considine played in the NFL for 7 years, earning a Super Bowl ring in 2012, playing the special teams for the Baltimore Ravens. Scott Helverson, I know you have to leave in a few minutes, so let's start off with you and get the read on the pressure for a game like this. How much different is the pressure during a playoff game or a Super Bowl for a back judge?
Well, mostly the pressure comes from we're the only game in town, you know, and everybody's watching and all the eyes are on the game. And when you got 100 million plus people working or watching on TV, everything is scrutinized so much more on those type of games.
Can you allow that to enter your focus? I mean, you can't really think about that, or does it inevitably cross your mind how many eyeballs are on you?
No, you really can't. You're not like a player. You know, you got a lot of nerves, and you're kind of uptight before the game starts. When the ball's kicked off, you get back in your routine, and you start concentrating on what needs to be done, and all of your keys, and all the things that go on while the game's going.
Mm-hmm. So, as an NFL back judge, you are the guy who does what?
Well, my primary responsibility are tight ends or slot receivers and long passes, long runs, punt plays, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. What are the biggest challenges in a really big game, like a Super Bowl, for an official on the field?
Well, the biggest challenge probably is you don't want to make a wrong call. You know, you want to do what you've done all year long and make the calls that are most important and are the big ones and try to stay out of the way and let the players play.
Mm-hmm. You were part of a crew for the 2008 Super Bowl that was held in Phoenix and were involved in a key call. Can you remind us of what that call was?
Yeah, it was Eli Manning and David Tyree at the time, and it was a late drive in the game, and it was a long pass where Eli made a big scramble and got away and made a long pass downfield to David Tyree. That was kind of a critical catch in a big situation with about a minute and a half left in the game to go down and seal the victory.
Mm-hmm. And what was your part in the call?
I was in the middle of the field, kind of where the catch took place, and it was a catch where David Tyree and Rodney Harrison both went up for the pass, and the receiver kind of caught it on the top of his helmet on the way to the ground, and it came like within an inch or two from hitting the ground and being incomplete.
Mm-hmm. What is the key to seeing what actually happens in real time? I know we have video replays now that where your work can be checked, but what is the key to seeing it when you only have one time and you don't know exactly when that crucial moment will happen in the 3.5-4 hours of the game?
Well, the biggest key is being in the right position and focusing on the right keys and being where you're supposed to be. And the rest of it's kind of just a routine that you've done for years and years and years while you got a lot of experience on the field.
Mm-hmm. Cold weather, outdoor game, the first one in Super Bowl history. What difference does that make for you as an official?
It doesn't make a lot of difference. They'll still do the same thing they've always done. They've got plenty of gear to be warm and to keep warm during the elements, and it doesn't change from indoor to outdoor.
You mentioned your biggest fear being making a wrong call. Have you made some doozies, some problem calls in the past?
No, knock on wood. Fortunately, I haven't made any doozies that I'm aware of. Anyway, well, you know, your biggest goal is to stay off the Sports Center. So far, I've done that.
so describe what would be a football official's nightmare. Do you have nightmares, or have you in the past?
Well, unfortunately, replay has helped me through my nightmares. I know I had a call my second year in an AFC playoff game. I was out in San Diego where we had a catch in the back of the end zone where I can't remember the receiver, but he caught it, switched hands with it, got both feet down, and it was a touchdown. And when I saw him switch hands with the ball, I thought the ball was moving. So I ruled it incomplete. and Replay came back and confirmed it was a touchdown. And those are a lot better, easier to sleep at night when you got somebody behind you that can help you, especially on touchdown calls.
Does it ever happen you have a sort of a Twilight Zone experience where you see one thing and then it's replayed and you say, that's not what I saw. It's actually different on tape.
Well, and that's part of the angle. That's part of being in the right position at the right time.
So it does happen.
A lot of times, if you're out of position, and you'll see something totally different than you would if you were in the right position, maybe 15 or 20 yards away.
Mm-hmm. Scott Helverson, I know you have to go. It's been good of you to join us for these few minutes. NFL back judge for 11 years, officiated in several Super Bowls. Where are you from in Iowa, Scott?
I'm from Des Moines.
Well, excellent. Thank you for joining us. Have a great Super Bowl Sunday.
My pleasure. Glad it worked out.
Also with us, Nate Kading with us, Sean Considine. Also with us, two players. Sean has played in a Super Bowl. Let's talk a little bit about pressure in big games. Nate, you've been in several playoff games. How are those big games different for a player? I mean, I can't think of a player, well, maybe a quarterback, receiver, but okay, I just did think of two positions aside from place kicker. But in certain games, we have all the attention on the place kicker. Does that focus, does that stress change the bigger the game is?
It does, and that's kind of the trick, is to let it not. And I've had my share of misses in those sort of playoff big game situations. But as I look back on it, I can't necessarily credit that to the amount of pressure per se in each game. I mean, there's certain mistakes that I made to miss those kicks, but I can't say I felt more pressure in that instance than I did per se in a previous game or a game-winning field goal, which I made plenty of those. But, yeah, I mean, that's the trick, is just to get back to your process and what you do, kind of like Scott hit on the head. If he knows where he's supposed to be in the right position at the right time, and if you go through your routine for me, you know, kicking in the net on first and second down, and you've got all these different processes along the way to put yourself in the right position, then as a kicker, the pressure shouldn't be anything, because you feel that pressure on every kick regardless of any sort of situation, because in my profession for the previous 9 years, if you're not making a high percentage of those kicks, you're going to be unemployed. So that's a pretty substantial amount of pressure in and of itself.
And indeed, very successful at it. Second most accurate field goal kicker in NFL history, 86.2% of your field goals. Sean, help us understand, as viewers, do you completely block out the people in the stands, let alone the millions watching in a Super Bowl?
I mean, you try to, like Nate touched on there. It's one of the more difficult aspects of playing in a big game like that. But, you know, fortunately for most people, especially like Nate and I, we have been in, pressure situations and then played in big football games before back in, high school. I know Nate won a state championship. I did too. And, won some Big Ten championships and played some great football games while we were at Iowa. And so you kind of develop a routine, mm-hmm. and a way to handle the emotions that come along with those big games. And the guys that can overcome that emotion and not let it affect them on the field are the guys that end up, being successful playing the game of football. And, for me, it was always about, I could handle the emotions or I can handle the nerves and that type of stuff when I was prepared. The games where, if I ever felt like I wasn't prepared, if I hadn't studied enough film, if I hadn't spent enough time in the playbook, and I went into a Sunday or a Saturday game not quite prepared like I should have been, then the emotions were going to get me. But when I was prepared, I knew I was ready, and that at the very least I could guarantee I could go out there and give my best effort.
Nate, so being prepared gives you the mental confidence. Was that the same for you?
Yeah, absolutely, and not only the confidence coming from the preparation, but also the track record of having done it. I mean, that's sort of the only chance you get. Sean and I made the transition from high school into Iowa, and you go from playing in front of 2,000 people over here at Iowa City West High School to in front of immediately 80,000 and millions of people at home playing in a Big Ten game, and you are going to fail certain times with that pressure. You're going to learn from those mistakes, and then you're going to build up this track record in your mind of, hey, I went out and did it. I made a 42-yarder against Ohio State or against Penn State. And then you start replaying those things in your brain, and that's what you pull from when you're walking out in the field in front of 80,000 and 8 million for an NFL game. And you sort of build that up, and your confidence gets increased by pulling from that larger pool of past occurrences when it's worked out well for you.
Sean, what's it like to run out onto a Super Bowl field?
Yeah, I think that's the one time period where you let yourself kind of take it all in, where you're, you know, in any game, and especially the Super Bowl, when I ran out into that field, you know, you're following your teammates and the music's going, and that's your opportunity to take it all in, to look up in the stands and understand, you know, that there's millions, hundreds of millions of people watching you. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you go into game mode. You know, you got so many responsibilities and so many things you need to focus on that you kind of block it all out. You know, the rest of the game, I don't think I ever pay attention to the fans or the stands or the cameras or the lights. You know, it's time to go to work and do your job.
So it is true in those first few minutes of a big game, Nate Kading, that you have there are jitters out there. The commentators always talk about the teams having to settle down. And so that's the few minutes maybe of a big game, the initial minutes where the focus of the players is not entirely where it should be.
Yeah, it's hard for probably someone outside of the game to understand, people like Sean and I. The most nervous moments I ever had were maybe the night before I went to bed before a big game, or driving to the stadium and, you know, all these things rushing through your head. But it's almost this sense of calm and comfort once you get into the locker room and you start that routine. I mean, literally, these NFL players, everything is scripted for them. You get a sheet, they'll wake up in the morning of the Super Bowl and they'll say 8 o'clock to 9:15 is the team breakfast. And then from 10 to 12, they're going to have walkthrough and some extra tape. And then 12 to 2, it's going to be some downtime. And you get to the locker, and literally, there'll be a dry erase board that says at 4:12, the specialists, the punters, kickers, long snappers will go out in the field. And you get to your locker and you see everything set out in the exact same place as it's always been. And you know the exact same time things are going to go. And then everything else just sort of fades away from there. And I would at least get less and less anxious as that sort of game preparation went on once I walked into that locker room, and it gave me that sense of calm. And then by the time the game starts, all the other stuff is gone out of your mind, and it's just time to go execute.
Mm-hmm. Sean, did you have a certain routine, a certain way of preparing? Perhaps you're superstitious. I don't know. A certain pair of socks you wore. I don't know. So that would comfort you.
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, over the course of, you know, of a football career, you start developing habits. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, I wasn't the most superstitious guy, so I wasn't wearing the same shoes or same clothes or anything like that. But I definitely had, you know, some food that I'd eat for breakfast that I had ate before that I felt good in the game, had energy. And so I definitely had a routine when I went to the things I was putting in my body.
What'd you eat?
I couldn't eat much before a football game. You know, you do have a little nerves and your stomach's a little unsettled and that type of stuff, which I think a lot of people can relate to. And so I'd have a little bit of oatmeal and one banana.
Yeah, nothing,
that was it.
Nothing tastes better. Those are some long, anxious 24 hours. Nothing tastes better than I'd always go to In-N-Out Burger out in San Diego in a cold Coors Light or something after a game like that, just to unleash. Those are some of my more favorable meals.
Uh-huh. Nate, what did you have for I'm in the traditions same before your game?
Same boat as Sean. I mean, I would have a real anxious stomach the night before. I could eat a little bit better, but the morning of, if I could get down some cereal and orange juice or something, I'd be lucky. Especially those night games that don't start on the East Coast till 7 or 8 o'clock. I mean, it's goes for a long day of trying to get food down and then hold it down after that. And there's a lot of nervous guys. That's the thing about the football that Dan touched on at the beginning of the show, is this is literally, it's 60 minutes and it's 60, 70 plays on offense, 60, 70 on defense, and 12, you know, 20 on special teams. And that's a lot of your livelihood and a game and a season, and to boil down into these small amount of plays as opposed to, you know, baseball and a best of seven series. And for these players that are out there, they're going to do it on Sunday. It's a lot of pressure to boil down into a couple kicks, or like in Sean's case, some key blocks, or Peyton Manning only throwing 30, 40 passes. So it's some trying moments for sure.
In the remaining 5 minutes we have, gentlemen, let's talk a little bit about the fact that this is the first outdoor cold weather Super Bowl in history. What are your thoughts on that? Was that a good idea? I guess we'll find out depending on the weather. I haven't checked the forecast lately. Sean, what are your thoughts from a player's perspective?
From the player's point of view, I think it doesn't matter. You know, if you have the privilege and are lucky enough to ever get the opportunity to play in the Super Bowl, I think of all the things you could be worried about, the weather wouldn't be one of them. And if I took a guess, I know that those head coaches are just preaching to these guys to not let that be something they're thinking about or worrying about.
Mm-hmm.
Those coaches, that's all they talk about is leadership and getting the guys thinking the right way. And I guarantee you they spent some time on, you know, maybe a few, 2-3 weeks ago to not worry about the weather. That's not anything they can control. There's so many other things they should be thinking about. And so, You know, the only people it's going to really affect, I think, if the weather happened to get bad, would be the fans that paid $2,000 $3,000 for a ticket. But I'll be honest with you, I'm sitting here in Byron, Illinois, going to watch the Super Bowl with a group of friends, and it's snowing and blowing here right now, and I would love to watch a football game that has this type of weather. I think it'd be entertaining.
Okay, Nate Kading, from a place kicker's perspective, boy, a place kicker wants everything exactly the same every time. So this is not a good thing for you, is it?
I totally disagree with Sean. I'll take the dome, but let me tell you what. Something I also learned in my 9 years is no one asks the kicker's opinion, especially in these sort of decisions. But I think from the NFL's perspective, if people talk about it, it's a good thing, and there's more people discussing the fact that it's a cold weather game. It's the first time it's ever happened. Is it going to be a blizzard? We're going to have to move it from Saturday to Monday, and they love that because it's just more discussion. Everybody, you know, cross medium, they're all talking about, you know, the weather and that element, and it's going to make for a more enjoyable game, and it's going to have more discussion about it, you know, before and after.
Sean, we played the clip a little bit earlier about a play in which you played and made a key block in a Super Bowl, allowing Jacoby Jones to take a kickoff 109 yards to help Baltimore defeat San Francisco. What was that like, that moment? Can you recall it for us?
Yeah, it was just an unbelievable, you know, we had a heck of a team. You know, offensively, Joe Flacco and what those guys were doing through the playoffs was amazing. We had a defense that was led by Ray Lewis and doing all his things. And, you know, I think what really put that Ravens team over the top last year was a special teams unit that was up to the caliber of what the Baltimore Ravens defense was and the Baltimore Ravens offense was. And, you know, we came out of halftime and said, we need a big play. You know, we were winning by a pretty good margin at that point, but we wanted to really put an exclamation point on that game. And Jacoby said, hey, give me some room. And, man, you know, when I got, you give that guy an inch, and he took it to the house. And it was fun. I mean, it was real exciting. And then the lights went out on us couple minutes later. You guys probably all remember that when the lights went out the Super Bowl, and it kind of slowed us down, but fortunately we were able to hang on.
Did you have that block planned beforehand, or did it happen and just kind of materialize and you said that's the block I need to make?
Oh yeah, that was a tough block for me. I was actually matched up. You know, I knew with that scheme we were going to run that return that I'd be matched up with one of their better special teams players who was a defensive end, you know, so much bigger than me. And so, you know, that's what I spent all week doing is studying him and understanding what he was going to do to take on the block. And you know, fortunately, through the things I learned, I was able to handle the block. And Jacoby came literally right off my backside. I felt him go by. I felt the whisk of air pass me by, and I knew he was through the hole. Because usually when you get a good amount of air go past you, that means he was moving through there without anybody touching him. And I took a peek and saw him, you know, head into the end zone.
He was gone. Are you wearing that Super Bowl ring now?
You know what? They make these Super Bowl rings. I got it in a trophy case here in my office. But they make them so big nowadays, it's not something you'd wear every day, which is a little bit unfortunate. But at the same time, it's a heck of a sight. And, you know, you bring this around kids or other people, and everybody really enjoys looking at it. The only problem is yeah, you don't wear it every day. It's way too big and gaudy to wear.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
Nate.
He'll bring that out at our Iowa football reunions and show everybody. He'll find a way to fit it on his finger then, I'm sure. Rub it into all of us that didn't get one.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we've got just a couple minutes left. Could you each briefly share, but I'm sure listeners are interested in what you're up to these days. Nate, what are you doing these days?
I'm back here at the Tippy School of Business getting my MBA. At the University of Iowa. And trying to chase around our three kids. So
that can take some energy.
Yeah.
Future football players?
Absolutely. Yeah, they'd love to. They're soccer and basketball and all sorts of fun stuff now. And when they get to be the age to do it, they'll jump right in.
What about Sean? What about you, Sean? What are you up to these days?
Yeah, I'm chasing five kids. We got we got four boys and a girl. We have 2-year-old triplets, and so I'm spending a lot of time helping my wife out around the house with the kids and small business owner since I've been back and retired and trying to, you know, dip my toe in the whole business world, which has been a lot of fun and a great learning experience for myself, and trying to catch up with Iowa football and watch the NFL and get together with some old friends like Nate and some of the guys I haven't seen in a long time since we've all been traveling, playing football and doing things like that.
be watching the Super Bowl from your living rooms, I expect, you two, Nate, this time, or are you going to be anywhere else?
I will. We've spent the last couple of years just kind of watching it at some restaurants and bars with some friends, but I think we're doing it at home, and I'm looking forward to really paying attention to the ads, too. It's going to be fun.
Okay. Sean, even though you're going to be tucked away nice and cozy in front of a big screen, are you going to be envious of the players on the field?
You know, I think whenever I watch a football game, you know, I miss that locker room atmosphere, you know, all that stuff going on behind the scenes. And absolutely, I miss playing football. But it's always nice to sit on the couch and have five kids crawling all over you and getting to do all the other things I'm doing now that I'm home.
Nate Kading, would you trade places, be out there on the field on Sunday? I'm sure.
I'd love to get another crack because I never had a chance at the ring, but the same way it was shot. I mean, that chapter's been closed, and we all leave the game with a lot of great memories.
Well, thank you for the memories you've shared over the last few minutes. Nate Kading and Sean Considine, thank you very much, and have a great Super Bowl Sunday.
Thanks, Ben.
All right, thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins, and Ames help from Jason Burns. And River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, a News Buzz edition. We'll talk about how one of the most significant and iconic modern masterpieces will return to Iowa. Can you guess what it is? You can find out tomorrow over the noon hour, our News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.